Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, The Pitfalls and Perils of Poor Security, part of an Avnet Hardware Hacking webinar series with Joe Grand. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, here with today's speaker, Joe Grand himself, who's representing Avnet Design Services. Joe needs no introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. He is a product designer, hardware hacker, and the proprietor of Grand Idea Studio. He is also the co-founder of Armored Things, which provides a secure cloud management architecture and gateway security services for IoT devices. Formerly known as Kingpin, Joe is a member of the legendary hacker group Lofty Heavy Industries, and has testified before the United States Senate. He was a Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Engineering. Technology. Quickly, we'll breeze through some housekeeping items before we get today's presentation, which consists of a video, so be sure to download the slides so that you can follow along. You can do this by using the Download Slides button, and other important features of your viewing console include the Forward to a Friend button, as well as the Ask a Question text box. This allows you to participate in the event by simply typing questions into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. We'll get to as many of these as possible during the closing Q&A, and you can also use the Submit Question button to submit troubleshooting issues. With that, we can go ahead and get started. Last, that all open system media is copyrighted and may not be recorded without permission.
All right. Well, welcome back, everybody, for session two. This is Joe Grand with you again. And today we're going to talk about the pitfalls and perils of poor security. And if you're with us for the first session, that was called Tools of the Hardware Hacking Trade, where we basically went through the tools and kind of a little bit of the process of how people are analyzing electronic products and attacking electronic products. So that was the tools. And then what I wanted to do in the second session is really go through some examples of how those tools can be used and some of my favorite hacks and sort of what I consider to be very relevant sort of hacking techniques or classes of attack for different types of products. And really to show you that as engineers, it's our responsibility to really try to think about security as early as we can and think about these processes of how people are approaching the product to attack it, so we can say, all right, if we know somebody's taking advantage of the UART interface or of a debug interface or sniffing communication, we can then try to prevent that during the design process. So it's sort of a, some examples. The third session, which is going to be next month, called Every Cloud Has a Silver Lining, is going to go into the best practices and common things that we can do to make our products more secure, to start to make them more secure, because you're never going to be 100% secure anyway. So it sort of is this, three-tiered approach of learning the tools, seeing some examples, and realizing that it is sort of our problem and our responsibility to make things secure, and then some recommendations on how to actually start going down that path. So for those who haven't joined before, again, my name is Joe Grand. I run a company called Grand Idea Studio. And a co-founder of a new company called Armor Things. I basically am a professionally trained, formally trained computer engineer. So I've designed a lot of devices, mostly consumer devices and electronics modules for hobbyists. And I've done some medical devices and industrial devices and some other things as well. I specialize in prototype design, but have gone through the entire, manufacturing lifecycle and brought high volume devices to manufacture and everything. So that's my real passion is designing things. But I also grew up in the hacker community since I was a little kid. And when I talk about hackers in these presentations, I talk about the good guys, people doing security research and analyzing problems and solving problems in unique ways. When I talk about attackers, that's sort of the malicious side. So you'll hear me sometimes use them together, sometimes interchangeably, but I think of hackers as the good side. Those are the ones you want to appreciate, and then the attackers are the ones that you want to, figure out what they're doing. I've been involved in the hacker world for a long time, since I was 7 years old, and just discovered I love the curiosity of figuring out how things work and how to defeat security and sharing that information. So I've broken and defeated a lot of security in products over the years. But I found that my real passion on that side is sharing my knowledge and enabling other people to either break the security of products or understand how they can better make their products more secure. So that's sort of, you know, the nutshell. So what I like to start off with is we're really part of the problem. And when I say we, I mean us, the engineers, the management, anybody involved in the product development lifecycle. We can't blame the lack of security on other people. A lot of times, in my past, I was part of a hacker group called The Loft, where we were some of the first people to find security vulnerabilities in products and go to vendors and try to get them to fix them. And what I hear a lot, what I heard then and what I hear now is, oh, that person, you know, found that bug and now we're insecure. The problem is the bug was already there. We just brought it to light. And if a good hacker or a researcher finds a vulnerability and tells you about it, that's a really great thing, right? Because they're actually bringing it to light, as opposed to if it's a malicious attacker or a nation state or somebody else that wants to keep it to themselves, you're not going to hear about it. But the bug is still going to be there. So really it's something that if we can get rid of these bugs and fix the problems earlier, we won't have to, you know, we won't have to worry as much. And it's something that I see in the engineering industry, you know, as the engineer side, is we are not trained to think like hackers or like attackers. We're trained to think like engineers, to design the product, to get it, you know, functioning properly, to get it in under budget, to meet specification, all of these things. And security is one of these things that sort of comes on at the end and is sometimes tacked on of like, oh, okay, now we know everything works. Let's try to, you know, maybe encode or encrypt communication, or let's try to tack on some other thing without a password. And it usually doesn't work well when that happens. There's a bunch of, you know, really common security concepts that we'll talk about in the next session that gives people a false sense of security. And that's what happens a lot of times, and that's what makes products so insecure, even if you think you've done the right thing. And some of these examples will show that as well, that we can defeat, you know, systems that have a pretty decent secure boot process by simply causing part of that process to fail at a certain timing. So it really is something that you need to build security in from the start, and that's much easier said than done. It's not an easy task. So it's something that, you know, time and effort are going to have to go into it. Resources are going to have to be put on that project to make a device secure. And that's the balance of how do you fight for that to make your product secure, but how do you also justify that in the grand scheme of the entire product development cycle? So it's not, you know, it's very hard. So don't take this presentation of like, oh, well, Joe, you know, Joe says you should design things securely, but it's really hard. He makes it sound easy or something, but it's not. You know, it is a challenge, and I know that, and we know that as a community. But it really is like acknowledging the fact that people are going to look at your product and just making it harder, right? Just getting rid of what I call the low-hanging fruit, which a lot of these examples that I'll show you go into. If we can get rid of that stuff, it's going to increase the required skill level of people looking at your product, and maybe they'll go on to something else. If it's a targeted attack, maybe they're still going to look at your product, but it's going to make it harder. And the way things are in the industry right now is it's too easy. And I'll show you some examples of that. So the other thing, too, as being part of the problem is instead of a lot of times acknowledging the, you know, if a researcher comes to a company and says, hey, I found a security problem or I found this weakness, instead of saying, great, thanks, send us as much information as you can so we can try to fix it and, you know, roll it out in a patch or redesign, you know, add something in the next revision of hardware or whatever it is, companies a lot of times will either ignore it, you know, they'll just cover their ears and say, you know, la, 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 I don't want to hear it, or they will try to have, you know, they'll have some sort of knee-jerk reaction and try to shut you down, either in the case of a lawsuit or cease and desist or something, you know, basically throwing lawyers at the problem. And that's not good. That's not a good relationship, and that's not good for the community. I'll talk a little bit more about that specifically towards the end of the presentation. But it really is, again, it's, you know, something. If somebody finds a security problem, like, that's great. It's only going to make your product better if you can fix that, or at least work with the engineer to understand you know, what can be done. So over time, we've seen that change in the security or in the software community. Back when I was with Aloft, you know, we would go to Microsoft and say we found a security problem, and they would be like, no, you know, no one's ever going to do that. So we would end up having to write some exploit code to demonstrate it to them, and then they would go, oh, you're right. And then they would acknowledge it over time. And now we see on the software side, like the web app side of things, bug bounties, mailing lists where you can write to, you know, security@company.com, and there'll be some security contact there to acknowledge issues. On the hardware side, not so much. You know, vendors that are designing hardware, it's a slightly different beast. First of all, because it's much harder to fix hardware problems, but it's just we're lagging behind where the rest of the InfoSec world is and the rest of the software world. So I think that's something we can, you know, work better on is working with people that do find the problems, because there's been a lot of times where researchers have released information or tried to work with a vendor and then they get sued and they have to pull a presentation from a conference, and that doesn't help anybody, because really by highlighting the problems, people can learn from that. And I think that's the most important thing. So I guess the question of all of this, you know, are we part of the problem? Like, who's responsible if simple security mechanisms aren't built into a product and they get hacked? Is it the engineers? Is it the managers? Is it the company? Is it the end user for not, you know, following directions to change default passwords on their webcam so they, you know, get hacked and turned into the IoT DDoS attack that just happened recently? So, you know, it's not a simple answer. But it's something we really need to acknowledge and deal with. You know, I talked about security kind of being put in place a lot of times on products after the design is done, after the core design is done. And I would say in general, security on embedded systems, on IoT devices, even on computer systems a lot of times are basically a roadblock. And as you can see from this epic picture, is, you know, people who follow the rules will sit on the driveway and wait for the gate to open. But, you know, hackers and attackers don't follow the rules, so they'll find a different way around it. And security and convenience end up being a trade-off. And in this case of this picture, you know, it's much more convenient to just go around the thing instead of waiting for it to go up. And that's the mindset that we're dealing with. People aren't going to follow the rules when they're looking at your product. So we need to think about that at all times. And we are seeing, you know, hardware hacking becoming more common. It's something where traditional software hackers or web app hackers can now get into. And what I'm seeing are a lot of my friends that are traditionally software guys are getting bored with the same sort of software vulnerabilities, and they're curious about trying out new techniques, so they want to get into hardware. And because we're dealing with embedded systems that are essentially, you know, general purpose microcontroller running some sort of code, it really is a small computer system, so software people can now get into this space, and it opens up this landscape. So before we go into examples, just some things about why would people get into hardware hacking? What, you know, why would somebody want to hack your product or attack your product in some malicious way? It sort of varies. It depends on the product. It depends, you know, on the goals of the adversary. I'll talk more about the different types of people looking at products next month. But, you know, it could range from just a curious kid to a nation state and everybody in between. There's, you know, different motivations, financial, you know, information gathering, whatever it is. So there's lots of different reasons. And you can't protect against everybody, but if you can at least sort of try to acknowledge and understand who your adversary might be, then you can work to properly defend that. So yeah, lots of different reasons. You know, counterfeiting is a big one. So reverse engineering some piece of technology to create a knockoff. So that might be as easy as opening up a product, identifying all the components, delayering the circuit board, getting an exact circuit board layout, and creating, you know, an exact clone of that. Maybe pulling off the firmware either directly with a device programmer like we talked about in the last session, or maybe you need to defeat the security fuse that's on there first with a chip level attack and then get the code off. So there's lots of different ways, lots of different reasons. Theft of service, you know, credit card information, personal information is basically high value data these days. So somebody might want to attack a device that either gives them something for free, but more commonly gives them some sort of user information that they can harvest and then resell. Bypassing security features, privilege escalation, basically getting root on a piece of hardware. And root is sort of like the super user, the administrator. So if you have, say, a network device that's like a router or an access point or any sort of wireless hub or something like that, if somebody can get root on that piece, they basically control that computer. And if they control a computer on your network, they could then move laterally to other devices on your network or send data out of your network. So it really is, you know, somebody else has access to your computer, and that's not something that you want to have. But that's the main goal. If you can get, as a hardware hacker, if you can get root on a system, that basically means game over. Once you're there, then you can make that control persistent and take it over. Forensic analysis and forensic intelligence. If you're on the digital forensic side of things, of needing to properly extract data from a device, like the high-profile iPhone 5 case with the FBI recently, they needed to extract data from the phone, but there was a password lock on there. So basically, they couldn't do it themselves, but they had to outsource to another company to essentially hack that phone and get the contents off. And I believe they had removed a device and done some brute forcing attacks against the chip with different passwords to try to get the decrypted contents out. So that's from a forensic point of view. It's really important. And sometimes there's this sort of battle between what the forensic analysts know, or say even law enforcement, the techniques that they know versus what are public, because. This is a huge discussion. If vendors are making their products more secure, then it's going to be harder for law enforcement and harder for forensic analysts and people that want to have access to that information, nation states, government agencies. It's going to make it harder. So on one side, it's almost like you have a group that would prefer to have things insecure, when really it's going to help everybody if things are more secure. Because if something has a backdoor, or if it has weakened encryption, or there is a known vulnerability in a device, somebody's going to know about it. Just like I said, if a good guy can find it and publicize it, it's pretty much guaranteed that there's going to be an adversary that has that information and is probably using it as well. Because a lot of times finding vulnerabilities is not a huge secret or a huge time sink to do. And then of course, security competency is one of my favorites. That's testing things yourself. Say testing the security of your own product, which is a really important thing to do, especially once we go through all these, various sessions of understanding the hardware hacking process and the techniques of like, okay, let's see if we can replicate some of these attacks against our own products. And if we can, then we can try to make them more secure. Or, on the other hand, if you're responsible for, say, deploying or recommending products to be installed in somebody else's installation, you want to make sure that the products that you're recommending actually do what they say. And that's something about being a hacker, is always sort of questioning what you see and not trusting everything at face value. So if you go to a conference where the vendors say, we have this device that's going to make everybody secure, just pay us off the money and install this device, you should be thinking, okay, well, that's weird. If everybody bought this device and would be secure, then we wouldn't have an issue anymore. So question that and say, why is that the case? Test various security schemes. And that's a really important thing. So, making sure the products are doing what they say that they're doing. So some common attack surfaces. This is just to have like a good overview of different ways people are attacking the products. And in the previous session, I talked about some of the tools that could be used for some of these different types of attacks. But I just wanted to have something in here before going into the examples of some of the really common things that attackers are looking at. So looking at memory, extracting memory, modifying memory with, say, malicious code, looking at for open interface ports like UART, asynchronous serial, JTAG, debug interfaces, using default passwords on things, just very common things. And it doesn't take a lot to have a huge impact by finding a vulnerability. Looking at different types of buses, say between a microcontroller and a crypto chip, or a microcontroller and external memory, sniffing those buses on the board itself, where a lot of times engineers don't realize, like, oh, somebody could open up the product and monitor communication between those chips, like who cares? Not realizing that that could give them a piece of information they could use somewhere else. Or maybe it's passing some encryption key, or it's passing some data that they're interested in the clear before it gets encrypted somewhere else and sent somewhere else. So having that physical access to the board is very important, and to be able to sniff communication. There's some other things. Side channel attacks are more advanced techniques of basically taking advantage of unintentional leakage of a system, whether it's the power consumption a system takes at a certain point in time. Maybe that's during a cryptographic operation where you can then extract the crypto keys. Maybe it's the time it takes something to happen. So you're measuring the time of, say, a comparison routine. And the longer the comparison routine takes means the closer you are to guessing the correct password. And that's a really common one. So you can, you know, take advantage of just inherent timing issues in standard C functions. And then, you know, that's sort of the hardware side. But then there's also the network side of attacks. Because these devices, sometimes, again, you don't even need to have, you know, an engineering degree or even be a hardware-focused person to start taking advantage of IoT devices or things connected to networks. Because we deal with, you know, bad protocols or bad implementations or improper configurations or default passwords again. You know, it generally is, the landscape for attacking hardware is so huge. And things are just wide open. So, like, if we can block out some of these sections, it's just going to generally make the industry more secure. So, going into some examples now, I picked a few, and these are some of my favorites. Some of them are slightly older. Some of them are more recent. But the real intention here is for you to focus on the type of attack or the class of attack that's done. Sort of the process and the technique, not necessarily the particular product or the vendor, because I don't want it to look like I'm picking on specific vendors, because I'm not. A lot of these vendors for this research have gone on to make more secure versions of their products. But it also is something where these are the ones that just happened to, you know, somebody wrote a presentation about or gave a talk or wrote a paper. And just because your product isn't mentioned doesn't mean you're secure. It just means that somebody maybe hasn't looked at it or gone public with the information. So it really is like, look at the classes of attack, the types of things that were done, and then think about, oh, could that be used against my device? You know, how could somebody take this example and turn it around to be used against me? And that's what we want to think about. And as you'll see, like the types of attack, the classes of attack don't really change over the, I don't know how many years that I've been talking about hardware hacking, you know, the tools have gotten better, more people have gotten involved, electronic products have gotten a little tougher to work with because of baud array devices and, you know, smaller component sizes and things like that. But really, the types of attack have not changed, and that's something that it never will. And if you know those types of attacks, you can apply them to, you know, later, more common types of things. So that's what we really are going to look at. And of course, you know, showing examples, it's important to learn from the past. And that's something too, it's really hard to keep up. It's hard to keep track of all the different attacks that are out there and different presentations and things. But if we can learn from these prior types of attacks that are public, we can then try to protect against, you know, future style of similar attacks. Okay, so getting into some examples, I'm going to start off at the lowest level, which is the chip level. And I've mentioned some die analysis, die chip level attacks a little bit, but this is sort of a specialized area that most hardware hackers or most adversaries, I would say, don't have access to this level, but there are people that do. So you could always, and what attackers do a lot of times, is if they don't have the skill themselves, they'll outsource to somebody else to do the specific work that they can't do themselves. And especially now there's, you know, facilities, a lot of them offshore, that can promise to do various chip level attacks that most people don't have the skill to do in their lab. So I'm going to start off with some chip level stuff just to sort of set the stage of, like, at a chip level, when you're looking at the silicon die, you can't really hide. At that point, like, you can make some attempts to protect yourself, but at that point, if somebody can get access to the die, you know, it's a very hard thing to fix. So we'll start with that, and then we'll move up to more of, like, system level things. All right, so this one, is the My Fair Classic is an RFID based device that's used. Used a lot for payment applications like the Oyster card in London, a bunch of different transit systems all over the world. I think currently there's 3.5 billion with a B of these My Fair Classic cards shipped, and hundreds of millions of them still used today. That was from a paper that I read from Black Hat. It was Black Hat in Sao Paulo a few years ago, the Black Hat conference. Hundreds of millions of these things still in use today. This work was done in 2008 to reverse engineer the crypto cipher that was used in these chips, because it was RFID communication, but NXP created their own cipher, their own encryption algorithm to use for the system. And that's something that generally is frowned against. You don't want to create your own crypto. You want to use, you know, industry standard tested algorithms, hopefully that haven't been, you know, weakened by governments. But this is something, I think the reason here is that they were limited by the die size on the smart cards. They only had, you know, a finite area to build their crypto and maybe couldn't build something more robust. So they designed their own crypto. And as part of this process, there's more to this to this work than just the die analysis. But as part of the process, what these guys did is decapped the chip, looked at the actual die of the smart card, and were able to look at the transistor level and recreate an actual block diagram of the crypto cipher by looking at the gates, at the digital logic gates, and recreating the circuit, which is awesome. And if you think about, you know, with a much larger chip, you might have hundreds of thousands or millions of gates. That would be a much different task. But the fact that this was a small cipher, they could visually recreate that cipher and put it into a block diagram and then identify some weaknesses and do some cryptanalysis and effectively break that system just by looking at the die. Well, I guess I shouldn't say just, but, you know, along with other reverse engineering. But it was a very, very clever attack. And that was 2008. And it's 8 years later, and there's still hundreds of millions of these being used. So the question is, you know, is the vulnerability a threat, or are companies just, you know, too lazy or too cheap to remedy the situation? I don't know. Here's a fun one with some configuration fuses on certain microchip PIC devices. And I know folks at Microchip will say, well, we fixed the problem, which they probably have, but this is still a very valid attack. For older devices and possibly for other vendors as well. So a lot of devices, microcontrollers in general, will have some sort of way that you can enable some very basic security mechanism. Usually that's going to be code protection. So if you program the firmware and, you know, program a binary into your device, you can click a button or set a setting that will say enable security bit, and that will prevent somebody, in theory, from taking the device, putting it in a device programmer, reading the contents out, or attaching a, you know, on-chip debug interface, programming interface to the device and reading the contents out, or being able to debug the system. It's a very simple thing to do, highly recommended. A lot of times vendors don't use these, and I'm not sure the reason why, but it's just a simple thing. If you enable code protection, that's going to, you know, prevent a lot of people from sucking firmware off of your device. And the way that it normally works is that if you needed to write to the device again, you would erase the entire device. And when you erase the entire device, that would reset the code protection bit back to an open state, which sort of makes sense. So a technique that a lot of people are using, if there is a code protection bit set, depending on the chip, the technique will vary, but it's going into the die level. You know, basically it's like, I like to say a silicon die is like a circuit board at a microscopic level, where you have lots of layers of metal connections and you have your transistors. So if you think about it as just a microscopic circuit board, you trace out, you know, bus and address connections, and you can sniff lines and all this stuff. But the technique here is to identify where the code protection bit or register or fuse, if it's a physical structure that is broken, is located, and then repair that in some way. And again, there's services offshore that will advertise that they can do this for older chips and for newer modern chips. But it is that roadblock. If you set a security bit, you know, lower level hackers and attackers aren't going to be able to easily pull out the firmware. So in this case, with the PIC device and surely with other devices as well, again, I'm not, you know, just picking on Microchip here, the code protection bit is part of what's called the configuration registers or the configuration fuses. And that's actually a set of registers on the device. And you use it to enable code protection, to set if you have an internal or external clock, or if you want to enable a watchdog timer, so sort of, you know, basic chip configuration stuff. And it turns out that register is actually based on typical sort of, I guess, floating gate transistor structures, like flash, you know, flash memory types of structures. And those are similar to old ultraviolet erasable EEPROMs, if you guys remember those, you know, common for PC BIOSes, for arcade games, where there's an exposed window and you would program the contents with the device programmer. If you wanted to erase the content, you would shine ultraviolet light on the entire device, and in, you know, 10 or 20 minutes, the entire device would be erased and you can use it again. So that structure, the technology, you know, chip designers are probably going to argue with me when I say this, but in general, that old sort of style of technology is still used a lot in chips. It just happens that the chips are covered over with plastic or ceramic, so you can't shine ultraviolet light on the entire die. So this attack is something that Bunny Wang did quite a while ago now. He had also hacked the original Microsoft Xbox and wrote a book about it called Hacking the Xbox. That's available for free if you search for Hacking the Xbox, published by No Starch. And he was curious about the fact he had designed chips and worked at a die level in the past. And he said, okay, I'm curious. If I can decap the chip of the microcontroller and cover over where the flash memory area is and then shine ultraviolet light on the rest of the system, is that going to reset the configuration fuses and let me pull the contents back out? And the answer is yes. So he was able to, you know, the middle picture you can't really see, but there's electrical tape over the flash area. And then he effectively erased the rest of the chip, but the firmware contents were still there, so he could pull them back out. Then Chris Tarnowski came around. He is, I would say, one of the best independent chip hackers in the world, and he's been involved in the community for a really long time and has done some wild stuff with breaking security of a lot of cryptographic devices. He said, okay, well, you know, Bunny has to decap the whole chip and put electrical tape over one section. I'm going to figure out exactly where the configuration fuses are and open just that area. And I didn't mention that. So when that work came out, Microchip revised the die and put another layer of metal on top. So basically like a covering over the entire chip. So if you decap the chip, there's going to be a layer of metal that you can't get through. So Chris said, all right, well, I can selectively remove metal wherever I want. And once he identified where the configuration fuses were by removing the entire metal first and identifying where, then future devices, he could just open up the hole that he wanted with his special technique, shine ultraviolet light and disable the security fuse. So pretty cool, you know, pretty cool method. But chip level stuff is something we need to think about. So if even though we do lots of stuff at a higher level, if an attacker can get access to the chip and has the skills and the resources, it changes the game. This example here, this is more about monitoring communication interfaces and spoofing communication interfaces. This was a parking meter attack that I did back in 2009 with Chris Tarnowski and also another colleague, Jake Applebaum. And this is a much longer story, but I'll basically give the short version of it. I had moved to San Francisco, and these parking meters were a smart card-based system. So you would buy a smart card at a store for a $20 or $50 value, put the card in the meter, there'd be some communication that happens, the meter would calculate the amount of money remaining on the card and then add time to the meter. And then when you pulled the card out, the meter would, you know, start counting down. And it would deduct money from your card, of course, as you're doing it. So I said, okay, I've never worked with smart cards before. I want to try to figure out how the system works. So I wanted to listen to the communication between the smart card and the parking meter, and eventually did that, figured out the communication protocol. It was an asynchronous serial interface, 9600 baud. You can see the image on the right. I set up my oscilloscope to do digital decoding so I could actually see the bytes of data being sent back and forth between the card and the meter and the meter and the card. made a smart card emulator that looked, is the picture on the left, which is a G-shaped circuit board, which is in the shape of my logo, that I use for my hardware hacking training classes that I give publicly and privately throughout the year. So I had a bunch of these boards already that were PIC-based. There's a PIC-16, F648, something. So I wrote a smart card emulator with that board to basically replay the entire communication that I had captured from the parking meter to emulate a legitimate smart card. So I did that. The system worked, so I could emulate a card and get free parking, but I thought that was sort of lame. Like, I wanted to get some more information about the about what was going on. So I ended up, you know, doing some more research, doing some more reverse engineering, figuring out how the card value was stored on the card, which was a 3-nibble value. For $20, it was 0AF hex. For $50, it was 127 hex. And I said, all right, since I have an emulator and I can control the communication, what if I set that value to FFF? Like, how is that going to affect the system? And I'll show you that. And then there's some other process, too. Like, I ended up finding from a satellite TV hacking website, smart cards, blank smart cards that had microchip PIC devices in them. So I could actually load my own custom code into a smart card and actually see the and use it as a normal smart card. So here's the video where I'm, you know, filming on the street, and I'm going to put my custom smart card in with this maximum value, and you'll see what happens. Yeah, so $999.99. That's a decent amount of parking in San Francisco, you know. Might be a wing or something like that. But this just goes to show there's no real authentication going on. Like, if I can do a replay attack and copy, essentially play operator and replay a bunch of data that had been sent back and forth to break a system, that's really bad. So, you know, if there was some sort of authentication or unique identifier on the chip or some sort of other way to prevent a replay attack, like some sort of session ID or some other generated information that can't be recalculated or can't be reused after it's used once, that might have solved some of this. So, you know, that was a really fun example. And I should say the city was very well responsive to this. You know, I gave the presentation to them and explained everything to them, and they said, well, to be honest with you, we're just more concerned of people not paying for parking than, you know, a high-tech attack. And I get that. You know, the risks, you know, vendors need to weigh the risk and users need to weigh that risk. So that was using an external interface through the smart card interface. Here's an example of using, you know, debug interfaces on chips. And I talked about if we set a security bit on a device, that's going to make attacks like this much more difficult. But in this case, that wasn't true. So this was some work. You guys have probably heard about the car hacking, the Ford hacking that had been done with Charlie Miller and Chris Malasek, where they were able to remotely compromise a moving vehicle and take over the infotainment system through a cellular interface, and then eventually reprogram a different interface on the car to then send arbitrary CAN commands on the CAN bus, whatever commands they wanted to the automobile. And they could, you know, disable the brakes and control the steering wheel and all sorts of scary stuff. The initial research they were doing was with physical access to the car through the diagnostic port. And both of them are friends of mine, and they're both very talented on the software side. And they said, hey, Joe, we need to pull some firmware off of these devices so we can do some reverse engineering. And again, it's the outsourcing of, like, if you don't have the skill, you just have someone else do it. And that's a totally valid thing in this world, in any world, really. So this is something that, you know, they said, all right, if we can get the firmware off, we can then go and see what sort of messages are being sent by these different electronic control units. So part of that, you know, reverse engineering, gathering clues process. It just so happens that these devices were both Freescale parts, which I have a lot of experience with. So I already had the development tools, some free development tools, the Code Warrior, you know, for S12. And then I already had the P&E Multilink, which is the recommended interface by Freescale for their background debug mode, programming and debugging interface. So I already had the tools, which was great. There was two different versions of the ECU that were sent to me. One of them was this larger one. And you can see the microcontroller on the lower right has a little pink dot on it to indicate that it's been programmed. And there was an unpopulated footprint right next to it. That was a 6-pin header. That's the recommended footprint for background debug mode. So all I had to do, once I figured out where power and ground were, because there was another board on top of this one, I just soldered a connector onto there, plugged in my debug interface, connected with the debugger, and just said, you know, save start address, end address, and dump it to a file. So now I have the full firmware with nothing. If code protection was enabled, it wouldn't have let me attach to the device and try to extract the information out. So, you know, this board, you could load new code in, arbitrarily execute code. The argument, though, I'm guessing from the automobile manufacturers is, well, this thing was so buried in the car that physical access wasn't really a concern. The problem is, a lot of times with hardware hacking is you're tearing something apart and getting access to information that are clues that you can then use to further your attack on something else. The second board we looked at was a smaller electronic control unit. I think this was for either the ABS system or the seatbelt or something. And this had a smaller version of the Freescale part and no obvious debug interface, probably because of space constraints. But I did know that device had debug support because I could look in the data sheet. I could see which pins were the background debug mode and did some continuity testing to figure out that they went to some of the test points on some of the, you know, the test points on that board. So I just glued my own connector to the side, added on the blue wires, connected up my debugger, and went through the same process. The only challenge with this board is there was some sort of watchdog timer or something that was resetting the part every second or so. So I had to figure out a way to defeat that. And I guess I could have gone and figured out what was causing the reset or maybe lifted the reset pin of the chip or something like that. I did try to use the debugger to disable the onboard watchdog timer, which didn't work. But I said, all right, I'm just going to let that happen and figure out a way that I can get the code off, you know, before it resets. So what I ended up having to do is dump smaller chunks of code before the system would reset, and then concatenate those back together at the end to get the full firmware image. A little bit of a roadblock, but not really. So that was with a vendor-specific debug interface, background debug mode, you know, just happened to be for Freescale. There's all sorts of other debug modes as well for other systems. You know, TI has bye-by-wire, ARM has single-wire debug. What other ones? I can't remember. There's a whole bunch. But then there's also industry standard interfaces, so something like JTAG, which I talked about a little bit in the session last month, where it's sort of the Achilles heel of an embedded system. If somebody can get access through JTAG, they have potentially, you know, full access programming and debugging and boundary scan to be able to read and write the state of the pins, you know, really amazing stuff. So this example is something that Barnaby Jack did of hacking an ATM using the JTAG interface just as a stepping stone to do the rest of his attack. I highly recommend watching the full presentation because he goes through a whole process of just a bunch of weaknesses all through this system, and even waited a year after finding this work to help the vendor, you know, give the vendor time to patch some of this stuff before this came out. Otherwise, it could have been a major issue. But his major goal was, you know, to take complete control. The ATM was a Windows CE-based motherboard, which I like to say is basically like a reference design. And if you're reverse engineering a system, chances are an engineer used the reference design for some of the major parts. So if you can get access to the reference design for those core parts, you could probably recreate a lot of the schematic without too much work. And I know that, right? As an engineer, I know we want to use reference designs because manufacturers are giving them to us. And of course, we want to design the system in a way that the manufacturer recommends. So we can use that as a starting point for reverse engineering. So in this case, he knew it was Windows CE. This hardware wasn't modified at all. So it was just a stock Windows CE system that had some software running on it to, you know, read the keypad and print to the printer and display to the screen. So he wanted access to this system. And he was also, you know, a very good hardware guy, but more on the software side. So if he could get access to the software, do some reverse engineering, he could basically take over the computer system, which is what he did. But what he needed to do is use this JTAG interface to switch what was happening on startup. Because normally when you power up the ATM, it's going to go and run the ATM executable. He wanted to run explorer.exe so he could start probing the system and figure out what was going on. So he used the JTAG interface to set a breakpoint and stop the boot process, change the pointer of what program that the system was going to load, and then resume the process. So he could load a different program in from an external thumb drive. And he just pointed, you know, the pointer in memory pointed to a different file name. Once he did that, he went through this whole process of reverse engineering the file system. There were some remote update routines. The system could connect with a modem or with over a network that you could then go upload new firmware. So he found vulnerabilities in there, created a rootkit, And ultimately, though, he could skim, you know, information. He could read credit card information and PINs. But the coolest thing was this video where, you know, he wanted to spit money out and sort of make it rain, if you will. And this one, you know, the video is longer. It plays music and does all sorts of crazy stuff. But you can see down at the bottom, you know, money coming out, which everybody loves, except the banks. So that was using a JTAG interface, you know, industry standard debug interface. This example here is working with a smart hub, so a consumer electronic device that's in your home that connects lots of different IoT devices to it, different wireless protocols, and it sends everything out through the network. So it's called the Wink Smart Hub. This uses a UART interface, so an asynchronous serial interface, like I talked about last month, are very commonly used for console connections or debug output, especially on Linux-based systems. And they're just left, those interfaces are just left on the board. They're less enabled and they're less accessible. So people take advantage of those all the time for lots and lots of different types of consumer devices. If you go to the Exploiteers website, they've hacked all sorts of off-the-shelf consumer devices, and a large percentage of them are because they can get access to the UART interface. So that's something to be aware of. But this example is really clever because this hub had sort of a smart, a secure boot process. Maybe not secure, but it had a decent boot process where it basically had a bootloader, and the bootloader would read, the check the contents of Flash, verify that they're okay, and the Flash is stored to kernel. So then it would read the kernel, unpack the kernel, and load the system. So it's sort of a multi-tiered process. But what these guys figured out is that they could cause the Flash check to fail on power-up, which would then drop them into a single user mode. Then they could use some software tricks to reconfigure some of the boot parameters and then reset the system, let the Flash check go through, and now they had root access. So it was really sort of a combination of a hardware and a software trick to get root access on a device. And once you have root access, again, you can do various things to give you persistent access. So what they did is grounded one of the I/O lines of the NAND flash. And that's all it needed to, you know, have it return the wrong data when it was doing its kernel check. So here's a video of that. It's, you know, a lot of text going by. If you go to the Exploiteers site and go to the Wink Hub, you'll be able to watch this video up on YouTube. But I did want to show it because you can see, you know, all this information that gets sent over this UART interface, over the serial interface, that's going to be sent, you know, whether you have something connected up to it or not. It's always there. And you can get a lot of information about a system based on what you're seeing on this, you know, debug output. So we'll let the system boot. It's going to take a while to start a bunch of different processes and stuff. And then pretty soon you'll see where they're able to get the Flash kernel check to fail, and they'll be dropped into the single user mode. All right, so now we see NAND flash, 0 bytes read, error, you know, something's not working, can't get kernel image. So now he's going to make some changes. I haven't been able to figure out for some reason that, you know, the text isn't showing up as he's typing, so maybe it was a baud rate issue or parity issue or something like that. But in a second, he'll get that fixed. All right, so now he'll print the environment variables that are used on startup. He's going to change those. Keep the original boot argument, but then add at the end a command to load a shell on boot up. And this is like standard, you know, Linux hacking software trickery at this point. Just change the variables. Now he's going to restart the process that failed, the NAND read. Let that run. It's going to quickly, you know, verify everything. And now that it has the modified boot parameters, it's going to try to load a shell. And now we're in a shell, and now we have root access to the device. So something very simple, you know, through that UART interface. I want to mention quickly sort of wireless functionality and the chance of hardware implants, which is almost a completely separate subject. But if people have physical access to a device, they could implant malicious hardware. So if you think about credit card skimmers on ATMs, it's probably the most common. But this example is from Joe Fitzpatrick, showing how he can easily use a little tiny Arduino module and an off-the-shelf radio module to plug in to a programmable logic controller, PLC, that are commonly used for SCADA systems, industrial systems for automation. And if you think about some malicious employee in a company that then goes and taps into one of these, you can then remotely control them. So this requires minimal reverse engineering of the actual circuitry. And what Joe ended up finding is the control lines to each individual relay, and tapped onto those, brought those to his Arduino, and then he could wirelessly control turning on and off the relays without any other, you know, any other control or any other intelligence needed from anywhere else in the system. So pretty clever, but a very simple thing. And physical access is a real attack. So a lot of companies will say, well, it's, you know, if they have physical access, then of course they're going to win. But you don't want to rely on that, because getting physical access to devices these days is not a challenge, especially if you have to do it quickly and then, you know, resume it back into service. It's something that can be done, and it has been done. So a few more examples here. Medical devices is all the rage these days. And this is an industry that you would expect medical devices, because they're, you know, saving humans and keeping humans alive, would be designed more securely. And unfortunately, that's not always the case. I'm hoping that things will get better. This initial work was one of the earliest public revelations about security devices, and this was a insulin pump that Jay Radcliffe had hacked. And Jay Radcliffe is a diabetic, so a customer of Medtronic, and he had some extra implantable insulin pumps and said, I want to see if I can hack my own insulin pump. And it turns out that it was relatively easy to do. He used, again, an Arduino microcontroller, a general-purpose microcontroller, a wireless transceiver module that the Medtronic device used, the TI chip Carn 1101, so he could actually, it's a very common chip, he ended up getting a little reference board for it and could tap it together with his Arduino and make a little sniffer and sniff communications. And since he had the insulin pump, he could remote, you know, he could press the buttons on the insulin pump and see how the data was being sent wirelessly. So ultimately, he reverse engineered a lot of the system and realized that he could, download the logs, change blood sugar levels on the displays. He could remotely dispense insulin using his Arduino. And that's a really scary thing if somebody can do that with no authentication. So he ended up giving this presentation, and Medtronic was really receptive to it. Jay has been working with them since then to try to make the devices more secure. The Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, has gotten involved, and now they have a series of recommendations that we'll talk about next month to make medical devices at least more secure. So the process is starting to get better, but it is still a very scary thing. And I think, you know, having designed medical devices, the concern is about, reliability of the devices and keeping the patient, alive and failing in the right way. But security had not been considered as much as it should. So when we're dealing with wireless devices, like, this is a big risk. Another example here is with pacemakers and implantable devices. There's been some research about this back in the day, 2008. A sort of seminal paper on this subject came out, where some researchers were saying, yeah, you can disable the settings of a pacemaker, you can induce fibrillation and all, induce a shock and stuff like that. So in 2013, the FDA came around and warned of attacks on medical devices. And then more recently, 2016, St. Jude Medical is engaged in a lawsuit now with a hedge fund that had shorted their stock based on research by a company called MedSec. And this is something where I had the honor of being an independent expert consultant in this case of independently analyzing the claims made by both sides about the technical claims of what can be done. And the extra witness report that is available now goes into the details, so I won't go into all of them here. But basically, there are tests that have been done to show that these devices are not as secure as they should be. And this is something where really we need to focus on fixing the problems and not fighting with each other about who's right and who's wrong. It's, you know, people are at risk, and it's something that we need to design products as secure as we possibly can. Again, getting rid of the low-hanging fruit. If there's wireless communication, having encryption, having, authentication and stuff like that. That's really an important factor. So then one final attack here, example. This is against an Xbox 360 device, a game console, and this is using a technique called glitching. And if you've designed electronic products, which I'm sure most of you have, devices in the data sheet, they have very specific defined operating parameters where you can only operate the system, within a certain voltage range or within a certain clock frequency range. And the vendor can't guarantee what's going to happen outside of those parameters if you operate a chip in that way. So glitching takes advantage of maybe on a reset line or taking control of a clock and operating a system outside of those parameters for a very short amount of time to cause the system to fail in some way. And usually that's going to be skipping over a compare routine or skipping over a password check or something like that. It takes a lot of upfront reverse engineering to know exactly where you're going to do your glitch. You need to know, and you don't at the beginning, is the glitch even going to work? Like, is the chip going to behave in the way that I want it to behave? So it is a time-consuming process, but certain systems are vulnerable to it. And this is something that you could do. In this case, the Xbox 360 had an actual secure boot process that was reading the code from a device, the boot code, doing a signature comparison on it to make sure it hadn't been tampered with before loading it. And that's like a pretty good approach for secure boot to make it harder for somebody to just arbitrarily execute code. And what they ended up doing, these game console hackers, is realize that if they send a reset pulse, if they control the reset line of the CPU and reset the chip very quickly at a certain point in time, it's going to skip over the signature check, which I believe was doing, it was doing a mem compare function. So they could skip over that or force it to always return that the signature was matching, even if it wasn't. So their process is they loaded their own code they wanted to execute into the external flash that was being read, during boot process. So they had their own code in there. They slowed down the CPU because at some point during the power on self-test process of the Xbox 360, which is essentially a PC, the comparison was happening after some point in post. So they were monitoring the post port, the 8-bit diagnostic port, and when they received a value that indicated it was starting the hash compare, they would then try to send the reset pulse to skip over it or to get the get the results that they wanted. It was not totally accurate, and it would happen. I think it took maybe 30 seconds to 2 minutes or something to happen. If the glitch didn't work, the system would detect that and it would reset itself and keep trying until it was successful. And I thought that was just a really cool way to, force the system into executing unsigned code and defeating a system that traditionally is a very, very well-designed system. And the way they had to do that is they had a little FPGA board, this Digilent board down at the bottom that they tapped into the certain lines and had some code on the FPGA to do the magic. But sort of an advanced attack, but something that is possible and is happening these days of doing glitching against power lines, against reset lines and things like that. So we want to test for those and see, like, is our design susceptible to these types of advanced attacks that are becoming more and more common. So some final thoughts with all of this. We talked about a lot of different examples with various classes of attack of getting access to, certain types of interfaces and doing glitching and doing wireless sort of studies. But really, hardware hacking a lot of times is so easy that even hackers are getting annoyed at it. And in the hacker community, there's a thing called junk hacking. And Dave Itell has a longtime security researcher, has a mailing list, or had one anyway, I don't know if he still does, called The Daily Dave. And he would, write about different opinions and there'd be discussion. So he wrote a little piece called Junk Hacking Must Stop, because there's so many hardware devices that are so insecure, and we see the same sort of things over and over again, opening the device, attaching to JTAG, attaching to the UART, doing some, changing of the boot parameters or patching something in memory and then gaining access to it. And he was just so tired of seeing that. So there, it started this whole discussion, like even people within the community, like these devices are so insecure that there's like not a lot of times anything special about seeing these products broken over and over again, which I think is sort of funny. It's like if the people breaking the stuff are getting annoyed, it's got to be really bad. The line is blurred between hardware and software. I talked about that, software people are getting involved in hardware hacking, and that increases the number of people that are looking at products, and it also increases the techniques that they're using and the attack vectors that they're using, because software people now are looking at software stuff, or maybe, there's people skilled in wireless that can analyze all sorts of wireless signals. So it's not just engineers looking at products anymore. And again, going back to my initial slide, everyone in the industry has to really make an effort towards security. And I think the first thing is accepting the fact that people are going to look at your products. And sometimes, somebody is going to call your baby ugly. And instead of, punching them in the face or suing them, you say, okay, I understand your point of view. Let's try to make that better. And it's really a hard thing. You know, a lot of times security researchers maybe aren't the most gracious in their process of finding a vulnerability or disclosing a vulnerability, but they're essentially doing a service for everybody. And if we can, you know, learn and use those pieces of information to make our products better, that's great. You know, it seems so simple. You know, getting feedback, whether it's positive or negative, is going to help you make products better. So I think we need to really acknowledge the fact that people are looking at our hardware products. They are being broken. Exploitation can happen at any point in the life cycle. I didn't mention this, but all these attacks are post-production, so devices that are in the field. I didn't talk about any of the malicious stuff that could happen during design or by the circuit board fabricator or by the chip fabricator or by the system integrator, you know, along the way where malicious things could happen, where hardware could be implanted or firmware could be modified if checks aren't in place to fix that. So, you know, it really is a wide-scale thing. Patching and security at the end isn't really, you know, doesn't really work, as we've seen in some of these examples. But really, we're all responsible for creating the best products, whether we're engineers or management. And I know it costs more money, it costs more resources, but it is something to, you know, this presentation series is to really get your mind going about, okay, let's see what we can do, you know, within the constraints of your organization. So thank you again for watching. The next session is on December 14th, and again, it's called Every Cloud as a Silver Lining. You know, we've talked about tools and examples, but not a lot about how to secure ourselves. So that's what we're going to do next. Sort of start that process of techniques and specifications and recommendations and best practices and all of those things that will get us on our way, you know, start the process. So, once again, Joe Grand, thank you for watching again. And let's pass it back over to the moderator and open up for questions.
Some great stuff there. Brandon Lewis, your moderator, here back with Joe Grand. And that brings us into a really brief Q&A session. I wish we had a little bit more time, but a really pertinent question just came up, Joe, and it is, how do you convince your manager of security threats and needs as an engineer?
So yeah, that's a tricky question. I think it sort of depends on what type of organization you're in and how much bureaucracy there is. But I would say really that what engineers can do is show by example. And if, you know, security is something that they're concerned with and perhaps their management isn't or that the company isn't, is maybe be a little bit of a squeaky wheel and do some experiments with your own products and show, you know, areas that could possibly be protected better and say, look, if we leave this open, you know, here are the pros and cons. If we leave, say, a debug port open, that's going to, you know, be easier for manufacturing, but it might be easier for somebody to hack as well. So it's sort of showing the pros and cons and maybe somehow trying to tie it to the bottom line of, like, you know, why is this important for the company? How could the company be affected if something is hacked? But it's sort of taking this proactive approach, and sometimes we have to do that as engineers, even though it's not directly in our, you know, line of work, and, you know, we are focused so much on getting the product working. But if it's something that's interesting to you, poke around a bit on your own and maybe, it might be hard to do during your normal course of the day, but maybe it's just something to do to kind of just raise that attention and raise that awareness. And maybe it's just a minimum of like forwarding on some links of some previous attacks and telling management or telling other people in the company, like, look, this happened to product X. We're very similar to product X. We should really take a look at that in our own environment. So I think that's really the main thing. It's sort of getting, you know, raising awareness, getting yourself excited about security to the point of that sort of becomes contagious to other people, and they go, oh yeah, we don't want to end up like that other company. And really, it's, you know, not targeting the people that are bringing these things to light, who essentially are doing companies favors. So, you know, the more that we can work together, you know, security researchers, internal and external, to the company, the better. I do also want to say quickly that in one of my hardware hacking classes, a student came up to me like a year after the class, who had worked at a company who, and that particular company was a product company. They didn't have any formal security group in place or anything like that, but she was really interested in the security side of hardware and of products. So she went to some various people in the company and was able to actually create a security group in that company. Part of it was because of different examples that she could show of why this was important. And the company decided to give it a try. So now she actually runs a group that's responsible for validating and verifying security of their own products, which I think is awesome. So, little by little, I think we can get there. And it's just a matter of, you know, getting people aware of of security in whatever way you can.
That's great. And I'm just going to try and squeeze in one really quickly, 10, 15 seconds on this. It's important to everybody. Where can people go to find out security exploits against their own products?
That's a tricky one. You know, it's really hard to keep track of what's going on in the world, in the hardware hacking world. There's just so many things coming out. But I would say really, you know, take a look at some of the InfoSec conferences. I think I mentioned this in the last presentation as well. Look at Black Hat and DEF CON and Recon, maybe some smaller conferences. B-Sides are community-run conferences all over the world. You know, hopefully if somebody finds a vulnerability in your product, they're going to contact you first, so you can try to work with them and fix the problem before they go public. That's sort of a discussion that's been, you know, happening for the past decade or two of how to properly, you know, bring security problems to light with vendors. So hopefully they do that first. But if not, I would just say keep on top of InfoSec conferences. You might see blog posts here and there from people, maybe something mentioned on Hackaday. But really, it seems like most of the work people will do, they'll find some exploit in a piece of hardware, and then they'll want to show it off at a large conference to get the big press and the big audience there. So, you know, hopefully they'll contact you first. If not, and you hear it, you know, if you hear it publicly first, try to contact them as quickly as possible. Figure out what their reasons were for not contacting you, and hopefully you'll be able to work together to fix the problem.
Great. All right. Unfortunately, that's all of our time for today. Some great stuff there and a really important topic today, probably more so than ever. I want to thank Joe for a great presentation there and then some good insight there at the end for into some of those questions. Make sure that you stay tuned as we continue this series. We'd also like to thank Avnet Design Services, and we at Open Systems Media and Avnet would like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some great questions. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search at any time with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCast there, available there for download as MP3. Thank you again so much for attending, and have a great day.